Good afternoon, everyone. We're here at syndicatednews.net. We're here again to talk about the topics that are so affecting our country. Tonight, we're going to talk about the George Zimmerman trial. They're going through jury selection right now, and they are they're going through all the detail that's required in a case like this. And we really appreciate all of you that have called in and sent email, and we've got people coming in right now here. We've got Eric Dubois coming in. We're waiting for his call. He's here already. We're bringing him into the studio. Today we were experiencing jury selection, and the jury selection was quite interesting in that the questions are very detailed and meant so that people who are merely trying to get onto a jury because they're interested in the topic can be weeded out from people who sincerely can serve on a jury, but would not be otherwise entertained with a project to do or to participate in a jury without having to actually be there because they want to participate in something exciting, but rather because they know that someone's freedom hangs in the balance as a result of making a very taking a serious step, whether in judgment or mistake or recklessness. And this is wonderful. Here we have our Eric Dubois. He's here with us. You're on the show. You're on syndicatednews.net. Thank you so much. We are so interested in hearing the detail. We're talking about the fact that at the George Zimmerman jury selection, it's a slow going because they're trying to weed out people who are simply trying to get on a jury because they want to be part of something exciting, and weeding them from individuals who can actually serve as jurors and do it with an open mind. Eric, tell us about your practice in Florida. Eric Dubois is a practicing attorney in Orlando, Florida.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. The jury selection for criminal defense attorneys and for the state is probably the most important part of a criminal trial because it's where you select the people who are going to hear everything. In Florida, because it's not a capital offense, you don't need 12 jurors. We only need 6. And I believe in this case, the judge is going to get 4 alternates as well. And part of the problem that you have is there was so much pretrial publicity with regards to this case in particular in Seminole County and in all of Central Florida, and for that matter, the nation. It reminds me a lot of what Orlando went through with the Casey Anthony murder trial, where eventually the judge, didn't even start with jury selection in Orange County, went out of town and went to Pinellas County. The judge in this trial is electing to start with, I believe they subpoenaed 1,000 jurors for this voir dire, this selection of the jury. In the first week, they had 1,000 come in. Today, I know there were 100 jurors who were called, and 41 of them were dismissed prior to questioning even starting, and then the attorneys after questioning dismissed another 40. And part of the problem is there's just so much pretrial publicity and so much going on about this case, and you want jurors who are going to be impartial. I mean, I think it's going to be impossible to find anyone who hasn't heard anything about this case, but you want jurors who are impartial, who don't have a predisposed guilt or innocence with regards to Mr. Zimmerman, and who have informed an opinion. Part of the issue that we saw we see in all major, you know, big high profile cases is there's so much evidence that we, the public, will see, but the jury will not because of evidentiary rules and things that are just not relevant or inadmissible in court. And that's kind of what all the pre-publicity does by both the state and the defense is try and put bugs in people's ears that they know aren't going to come into trial, but that are going to, you know, resonate. It's hard. Once the bell's rung, it's hard to unring that bell. So I hope that helps.
And today in court, I saw the expression voir dire bandied about by everyone, but the public wasn't aware of what that meant. If I was wondering if you'd take a moment to just spell it and explain what that means, voir dire, because most people didn't know the definition.
Sure. Voir dire, let me go back to law school spelling bee. I think it's V-O-I-R-D-I-R-E. It's basically
correct.
Where you have, oh, good. You have a panel of individuals, members of the community, because you're supposed to be tried by a jury of your peers. So in Florida, how we select jurors is through driver's license, the driver's license database, and just randomly picks people. So it's a cross-section of the community. It's not just from this neighborhood or that neighborhood or just people that vote or just people that don't vote. And voir dire is just basically a fancy phrase for questioning the jurors, questioning the panel. And it's where attorneys go through and you have a set questions that you ask everyone. There's a questionnaire that all the jurors are handled with regards to pre-trial publicity, their education, where they work, their life history, family members in military, family members in law enforcement, how many children, have they ever been a victim of a crime? If so, what type of crime? Typically, the jurors would be given those, and then they'd be turned back in, usually a couple of days before the trial. But in a case like this, there's such high publicity. People, and I think we heard some jurors today say that they were, or at least one say, he was concerned that if you rendered a verdict at the end of the trial that wasn't popular, the retaliation in the community. And obviously that's a huge issue for both sides, because there's one camp that wants George Zimmerman to be convicted of something, and obviously there's one camp that wants George Zimmerman to be acquitted. But voir dire is basically just a fancy expression, fancy words for the attorneys questioning the jurors and sitting a jury. It's just essentially questioning and filtering through. And you can see on both sides that they have, you know, the jury experts that kind of read the mannerisms, behavior, when jurors look up, when they look down, when they look left, right, make eye contact with the defendant. All those things are little body movements that we can't control, and that usually tend to show which way or if they're more favorable or not favorable towards the defense with prosecution.
And I noticed that today the George Zimmerman camp had a specialist that handles just juries and identifies from exactly what you said, the body language, the walk, the mannerisms. And that's the specialty. I remember one famous one was Dr. Phil. He was helping pick a jury for Oprah Winfrey's beef case out in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And
we had one. And I think the first one that I really recall and a big deal being made of it was the O.J. Simpson trial, his murder trial. There was jury experts, and they helped pick that jury. And they read the questionnaires. They know what they're looking for. As a criminal defense attorney, you tell your jury expert, this is what our defense is going to be. This is the kind of person we're looking for. Usually they're trained in some sort of psychology. And they know the perfect person that's going to do that. Obviously, you know, whether it's a male, female, younger, middle-aged, older person with kids, without kids, widowed, divorced, you know, they've got it down to a science, and it is a science, and they do a great job.
And what type of people do they try to avoid?
Try to avoid?
Yes.
You would avoid someone who, obviously, I'm not a jury expert, but I think you try and avoid someone who is looking for just the notoriety. You get that sense of notoriety and fame. If someone answers the jury questionnaire perfect because they're trying to think too hard as to what would they want me to say? That's the kind of person that I wouldn't want on the jury, because they're willing to say anything to get on that jury, and they're not wanting to be on that jury for, you know, what this country stands for, the right to be tried by your peers and, you know, innocent until proven guilty and our constitutional rights. They want to be on that jury because they want to be the foreperson, or they want to be on that panel because they want to write a book. And they're looking for the end result. They're looking for, you know, this is their lottery. They're going to hit the lottery and they're going to publish a book. So you look for someone who's too perfect. My opinion, someone in this, in, you know, a perfect juror for this case would be someone, you know, for the defense would be someone who's obviously has a firearm. I think, you know, one of the questions, I haven't seen the questionnaire, but I would imagine is one of the questions is, do you own a gun? Are you a member of it, you know, the NRA? Do you believe, you know, do you have a right to, you know, bear arms? So from a defense, it's going to be someone who, you know, has been, potentially has been the victim of a crime, or, you know, and carries a firearm. For the state, it's going to be someone who believes, you know, that's not appropriate, and that hasn't been a victim of crime, because obviously someone who's been a victim of crime is going to want to be able to stand their ground and defend themselves if they feel threatened, and which I would speculate is going to be the crux of the defense's argument.
And I noticed that some of the people that had signed the questionnaire and were interested in proceeding and being part of the process, once the attorneys began asking questions that delve into their personal interests and their religious background started coming out, and their moral considerations started to surface, the attorneys realized that one individual after another wasn't suitable because their interest was not fairly just to want to come in and help out and do their part and follow instructions, but rather they were there for the wrong reasons. It was very obvious.
Right. And, you know, religious conviction is one important, you know, one factor. I would speculate that one position, one question is on there. You know, are you a registered Republican? Are you a registered Democrat? What's your party affiliation? You know, there's all those things. Those things play in part in making a decision. I mean, jury selection is, I would argue, 75% of the case, especially for the defense. For the defense, their case is won or lost in jury selection 9 out of 10 times. You got to remember, all you need is one person. You need just one person who's gonna find reasonable doubt, and it's gonna, you know, give them what they want, which in this case is an acquittal.
And I noticed that the attorneys were being really patient, hearing each person out, and sometimes the responses would be the reasons why they sounded unusual. Today there was someone that sounded so perfect that it seemed impossible that the individual has gone through life, through these, especially this past year, and never heard, seen on television or heard on the radio any broadcast that mentioned George Zimmerman or Trayvon Martin. And everyone found that incredible. And the more they delved into asking that person questions, the more firm they were in that they had not at all ever watched television and seen either party or heard about it on the radio, had never discussed it with a neighbor. They had never been anywhere where the discussion went on, which is almost impossible in Florida. But then it started to emerge that this individual already had an opinion and had made up his or her mind. I'm even trying to stay away from gender so that I don't violate any
right.
privacy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you know, if I was in the defense team, and the state attorneys are all very qualified attorneys. I know, you know, Mark personally, great guy, but I would run as far away from that person as possible, because they're already lying to you, in my opinion. There's no way. It's on the front page of the paper. It was on the front page of the paper. It was on the front page of, you know, every first story in every newscast in Central Florida, you know, all of February, March, and April of 2012. There's no way. I mean, you had to, you know, be held up in a cave to not hear anything about this case. So that person, obviously, in my opinion, if I was the defense attorney, I would strike that person or find a reason to get rid of them, just because, in my opinion, they have ulterior motive.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And
but yeah, what I think we all have to be very. I mean, this is going to be a long process of selecting this jury. You know, it's going to take. My guess would be 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks of just selecting the jury because, you know, just because they kept 19 people today and didn't excuse them doesn't mean that those 19 people are all going to be qualified to sit on the jury. This is just the first, you know, cursory, you know, questioning of the juries and one of the jurors. And one thing that I found also interesting is, you know, right now there's no plans on sequestering the jury. That's my understanding. Once the jury is seated, that could also, you know, that also will be brought back up, I'm assuming, by the defense to have them sequestered once the jury is impaneled. Because this is going to be, I mean, it's going to be news coverage, you know, 24/7 in Central Florida.
And they kept 15, as you said, but they did let 40 of them go. They were totally released.
Right. Well, I think they let 81 go today. There were 40 that never made it up to the courtroom and 40 go after they were questioned.
And in cases of this magnitude, how long do you think the trial would take?
4 weeks, I guess. You know, a lot will depend on, I mean, this is going to be, in some extent, it's going to be a battle of experts. Obviously, the state is going to provide testimony and experts that say that voice that everyone hears screaming on the 9/11 call is Trayvon Martin. The defense is going to put on its own experts that say either it's not Trayvon Martin, either it's George Zimmerman, or that it's just impossible to determine at this point. You're going to have, you know, and the million-dollar question is going to be, there's only one person that really knows what happened that night, and he's not forced to testify against himself. He's not forced to take the stand. And the question is going to be, if George Zimmerman takes the stand, how long is he on the stand for? Because you know that's going to be at least a 2 or 3 day questioning of him.
Correct.
There weren't many witnesses that saw their people that heard stuff going on. So that's where I think the trial isn't going to be as lengthy as, say, the Casey Anthony trial, but it's not going to be a 1 week trial. My guess is it's going to be probably a 3 to 4 week trial.
That's pretty quick, actually. The longer side will be picking the jury. What do you think?
Part of the problem that the judge is going to have in this case is, you know, once again, we're coming up against the July 4th holiday. If jury selection takes 2 weeks, there we are right on the edge of, you know, July 1st. Do you keep the jury? I mean, if you don't sequester, how do you can't start trial on, you can't have court on Independence Day. Do you have court on the day after, you know, the 4th? And you've got some of those. You have court on the weekends. If you don't have court on the weekends, how do you keep the jury from hearing anything about what's going on? That's why, you know, I'd be surprised if the sequestration of the jury isn't readdressed by the judge once it's impaneled. Now, the other problem is once you seat this jury, how many people, unfortunately, in this economy can afford to take out of work for 2, 3, 4 weeks without real compensation? I mean, they get paid from the state, but I think it's $8 a day.
Exactly. Something very small like that, yeah.
And, you know, it's part of our civic duty. We're supposed to do jury duty, but, you know, I don't know many people that can afford to take 3 weeks off of work. You know, and that's where you get into this. Are you really doing this because of your civic duty, or are you doing this with I can take 3 weeks off of work because I'm going to write a book and make $150,000.
That's an absolutely real consideration. I remember during the Casey Anthony case, there were admonitions about being a participant and then profiting from it. And the very next day after the verdict was announced, mm-hmm. the prosecutor at the time came out with his book. It was released the very next day.
I mean, the admonitions in the Casey Anthony trial were really with the jury. And Jeff Ashton, one of the prosecutors, and
yes,
his his book came out, but that was his tell-all story from his perspective. Jose Baez has come out with his from his perspective. What I found more interesting about the Casey Anthony trial was that once the verdict came out, how quickly some of them were to talk to. I believe that Greta Van Susteren got the first interview with the four person, but they were very private in, giving out the information. They kept it all confidential, which I think Judge Nelson in this case has made a wise decision in keeping, all the juror information confidential, including those that are called. And that's why, no one knows who was called for the voir dire, who's going to be, once the panel sits, the jury is impaneled, who's actually on the jury. And I agree with that. I mean, I think it's wise. It's best for the community, and it's going to promote, justice and make sure that, Mr. Zimmerman and the state both get fair trials in this case.
And as cases go, Judge Nelson, she really keeps this case on track and moving along, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would. She's a great judge, and I think, she was. She had a date in mind. She had Monday set, and she's going to keep them moving. I would not be surprised if she doesn't follow some of what Judge Perry did in Orange County during the Casey Anthony trial and holds court on Saturday just to get these things, just to get it moving, maybe not all day, maybe half a day, three quarters of a day. And depending on, the jury, honestly, they may go past 5 o'clock some nights
She didn't say that.
Yeah, just to get it done. And that's, it takes more court resources, yes, but at the same time, it's a lot quicker and a lot more efficient to get it done in 2 weeks using some overtime than make it drag out for 3 weeks, three full weeks. So I would not be surprised if she keeps them moving.
Just to finish the jury selection, we were there Monday through Friday, and then she said, report tomorrow morning, we will continue, and she did. She continued through Saturday. Was a working day here at the court.
Yeah, and I would imagine there would be testimony on Saturdays. I think Sundays are highly unlikely, but Saturdays will probably be a definite.
And Eric, give us your website name and your phone number in case someone in Florida is in need of an attorney.
Sure.
Absolutely. It's very important.
The name of the office is Dubois Law Group. We're in downtown Orlando. The webpage is www.dubois, that's D as in David, U, B as in boy, O, I as in igloo, S as in Sam, lawgroup.com. We're pretty much open 24/7 and by appointment on the weekends and after hours. And I'd be happy to help anyone, family law, criminal work, and some foreclosure and bankruptcy work.
So you're a full house. It's a one-stop shopping law firm that can any type of problem. And I'm sure that if it's a problem that you can't handle, you have associates that can pick the case up and give a hand.
Yeah, we can handle anything. I've got friends in the community that if it's something that we don't handle in house, that I can refer out and make sure that someone is represented by someone who's confident that I would refer a family member to. And that's, to me, the threshold that someone needs when they're looking for an attorney.
I remember when we began to schedule this program, we scheduled William Schaefer. And
mm-hmm.
when we start looking at his schedule, he was working 15 to 18 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I said, please, go get some rest. And we were very, very grateful that your background and your office had handled so many types of cases and that you could give us a hand with this, because you're exactly the type of lawyer that a typical individual would need in a case of trouble.
No, I'm glad to do it. Bill's a great guy. He's going gavel to gavel, so he's pretty busy. So, but I'm glad to do whatever I can to help you all.
And we at Syndicated News are going gavel to gavel as well. We've been there for every single hearing, and we will be there for every single date. We actually arrive at the court around 8 a.m., and we're there till the end of the day. And it is strenuous because the details are so clear, and you can't really take any of this for granted because a man's life hangs in the balance. And a life was already lost. This is such a severe matter. It's not a frivolous case. It's a severe matter. And there is no room for joking or great humor. There's no room for speculating. Everything has to be exact. Everyone's trying not to make any mistakes. And everyone's trying to put their best foot forward because this is such a tragic case as it is. And I wanted to ask you if you would explain for the public what Stand Your Ground law is, because it's not a law that exists in all states in the United States, just a handful of states. Would you explain to the public what Stand Your Ground law is exactly?
Sure. What Stand Your Ground law is in Florida is that an individual who is in fear of great bodily harm or in fear of their life has the right to defend themselves and essentially stand their ground. And in Florida, great bodily harm is defined as essentially drawing blood. So if, in this case, you know, if the facts are, as the defense wants us to believe they are, that Trayvon Martin was beating George Zimmerman and smashing his head against the deck, and the defense's position is that he had a right to stand his ground, which meant he had a right to meet that danger. He was in fear of his own safety and his own body being, you know, gravely injured or severely injured. He had a right to meet that with force to defend himself. Part of the uniqueness about this case is that the Stand Your Ground is a defense, but it's also an immunity. And what the defense did prior to trial was it waived that immunity hearing initially. And it said, we're not going to use that immunity, which basically would have been a trial before the trial. And they would have had to show their hand and show their card to the state in exactly what their testimony was going to be, what their evidence was going to be, and what their position and how they were going to play their card was. Doesn't mean that once the trial starts, they can't say all these things happened and use the, you know, we have a right to, he has a right to defend ourselves. And, you know, essentially like some very similar to self-defense. But they're not going to have that hearing because what would have happened if they did a true Stand Your Ground immunity defense, Judge Nelson would have had a hearing prior to the trial starting and hear all the testimony and make a decision whether or not Mr. Zimmerman had a right to stand his ground. So it's like a trial within the trial. And that's what the defense waived. But basically, Stand Your Ground in Florida means that you have a right to defend yourself, a right to meet danger, with you know, defense, and protect yourself.
And even so, when the circumstances to meet danger with danger, I'm assuming that the danger is usually equal. The response is equal to the threat. If someone waves a stick at you, for instance, and you have a huge weapon or something that's very large, for instance, you can't gun a car at them. It's got to be equal,
correct,
more or less.
Correct. Basically, what it means is you don't have a duty to retreat. You don't have a duty to, you know, take a step back. And part of what I would imagine the defense is going to argue in this case was that, you know, George Zimmerman approached, this is pure speculation, obviously I don't have any inside knowledge, that George Zimmerman approached Trayvon Martin, asked him what he was doing, that initiated an argument and a physical confrontation between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, in which Trayvon Martin hit or cold cocked George Zimmerman in the nose, knocked him to the ground, was on top of him, hitting his head against the pavement. George Zimmerman was in fear for his safety. Blood was drawn. His nose was bleeding. And he didn't know if what else Trayvon Martin had, if he had a gun, if he had a knife or something. And he reached for his gun and pulled the trigger to defend himself, to create space between himself and Trayvon Martin. Unfortunately, fatally wounding him, but that he was justified in doing that because he felt at the time, and again, this is the only person that can know that is George Zimmerman himself, which I don't know how they're going to do this case without him testifying, that he felt in fear for his own safety, and that the only thing he could do was pull that trigger at that moment. From the state's perspective, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, we noticed that he already agreed that he is not going to use the stand your ground law as a defense. He backed away from that, and Judge Nelson made him come in and say so to her directly, that he understood that his attorneys were not going to pursue that line and that he agreed with it.
That's the stand your ground immunity. That's that trial within the trial. That's him saying, I understand that they're not going to bring this, that they're not going to raise this now, and that we're not going to have this hearing, and I forego the immunity hearing. It doesn't prevent him from, in the trial, using it as a defense to say, I had a right to defend myself because I was in fear for my safety. And if you look at these pictures, why is my nose bloody? If you look at the back of my head, why is the back of my head scraped up? I was in fear for my safety. And I didn't know if he had a firearm. I didn't know if he had a knife. I didn't know what he was going to do to me. And that's what happened. So he can still use it to a certain extent. It's just that immunity hearing prior to the trial is waived.
And I'm sure there's going to be quite a bit of arguments when the prosecutor states again that the dispatcher had already told George Zimmerman, are you following him? And they said, we don't need you to do that. There's a question of whether that was a command or just a request.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's one of the biggest obstacles that the defense has, is that George Zimmerman was told, you don't need to pursue, stay in your car. And he could have just stayed in his car and avoided all this confrontation. From the stand your ground perspective, that's going to change. Was George Zimmerman the aggressor by confronting Trayvon Martin after being asked, although the dispatcher is not a deputy, so he wasn't disobeying a law enforcement order. They're not deputized.
Thank you for mentioning that. That's so important, because much of the public thinks that because the dispatcher made that statement, you don't need to do that, you don't need to follow him. They felt that message, that statement from the 911 dispatcher, was an actual order from the police department. Would you help us distinguish between the two? Because that's a very important point. You're right. They're not deputized. They're not police officers. They are 911 dispatchers.
Right. So, you know, in Florida, a 911 dispatcher is a layperson, is just a member of the public whose job is to basically relay calls to law enforcement. They work for the sheriff's office, or they work for law enforcement, but they're not deputized. So they can't order someone to do X, Y, or Z. So when George Zimmerman called in to dispatch, he was asking for a deputy to come out, and they suggested to him, we don't need you to follow. Now, it's not a lawful command. He didn't disobey a lawful command by a law enforcement officer. From a defense attorney's perspective, it was requested that he not pursue. He chose not to because, as the neighborhood watch person, he was concerned that something was going to happen. So that, to me, is where the crux of the prosecution's case is going to be, is when that happened, did that trigger George Zimmerman then becoming the aggressor towards Trayvon Martin? Or is that, from the defense perspective, that was a mere request, and George Zimmerman was just doing what his volunteer obligation was asking someone, hey, what are you doing here? I don't recognize you. Can I help you with something? And then he became the victim of Trayvon Martin's aggression. That, to me, that's the crux of the case. Whatever the jury believes there is going to result in either an acquittal or a conviction of George Zimmerman.
That point has been discussed repeatedly, and once the public gets to that aspect of the dispatcher saying, you don't need to do that, meaning you don't need to follow him, everyone assumed that that was a police command and that basically George Zimmerman wasn't following a police request or order. And it's not an order. It's not. They're not deputies. They're not police officers. They are 911 dispatchers. And the public doesn't really know the difference between the two. They thought that because a dispatcher is hired by the police department or the sheriff, that when they make a statement, you have to follow their instruction as though it's a police order when it's not.
Right, and I think the defense will spend probably 2 or 3 hours calling witnesses to testify as to what and how a police dispatcher is hired, what their training is, what their classifications are, what their, you know, rights and responsibilities are, whether or not to deputize, to explain that to the jury. And part of what's going to be hard, and I think we've seen this in a lot of high-profile cases lately, whether it be Casey Anthony, the Jody Arias trial, you know, the O.J. trial years ago, you know, all these trials, is what the public sees and what the public hears outside of the earshot of the jury is sometimes night and day from what the jury has to work with. The jury doesn't see all of this, and the jury may never hear some of these things.
I listened recently to a discussion here on Blog Talk Radio about the George Zimmerman, now is a trial, then it was a hearing, and now it's a trial. And I remember people in panels were saying, oh my gosh, if you knew all the stuff that went on there, the information that they have not released to the public is outrageous. There's so much of it. And it's true, and it was very clear, the judge made it very clear that even as members of the media, whatever information we receive, we can't actually go and discuss it and speculate and make decisions on it, and we have to allow the court process to proceed without interfering simply because we want to write about the story or simply because we want to discuss it. And I've had the situation where I'll sit at a table and the discussion is going on, but because I'm participating as a media member, I actually don't participate in the discussion because it's awkward, and I want to be careful that I don't repeat something that the judge has already mentioned she doesn't want discussed in open conversation. Rather than risk it, I choose not to discuss it at all with my family.
Right. No, it's tough. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, I'm most familiar, obviously, locally with the Casey Anthony trial, and there was a lot of evidence and a lot of information that the public saw and heard about that the jury never saw. And
absolutely. That was
I think one thing that, to my knowledge, the judge hasn't ruled on yet is whether or not this audio tape and the audio tape analysis, an expert is going to be able to testify as to whose voice it was. It's kind of cutting edge. I mean, it's, you know, everyone has done regular voice analysis, but no one's testimony has been, for the defense was that you can't analyze a screaming voice, and it was hard to determine, and the state saying, no, it was clear cut that it was Trayvon Martin. That issue still has to be resolved. There's going to be a lot of those types of issues that are going to come up during the trial that the judge is going to have to rule on, which is what's going to cause some, extra delays in the length of the trial. But I think my guess is, knowing the judge, is she's going to have those hearings after hours, before court, so as to not interfere with the jury's time and respect the jury's time and get them in court hearing as much evidence and as much testimony as possible between 9 and 5, and deal with the extra stuff after hours when the attorneys are just there.
And I wanted to ask if you would explain to the public the difference between a voice analysis and an actual, what they call a lie detection test, because many people, when they hear the word voice analysis, they think immediately it's a lie detector test, and it's not. Would you explain the difference to us?
Well, lie detector tests in polygraph machines and polygraphs in Florida are generally inadmissible evidence because they're not scientifically, you can't rely on them as well as you can other evidence. A lie detector test is basically a series of questions that an individual is asked in person while hooked up to a machine that registers and monitors their heartbeat, their heart rate, their pulse, the body temperature, all sorts of characteristics, and registers those reactions. And there's certain questions that are asked the individual that are known to be false, and certain questions that are known to be true. And then there's other questions that deal specifically with whatever the issue is, if it's a crime, that will dance around the heart of the issue. And a trained lie detector administrator can tell when someone's lying or not lying based on the registrations of the code, the printout. It looks like the tape looks very similar to an EKG report from a cardiologist. It's just lines bouncing up and down, and they can see huge swings. And you can tell that's when someone's lying about a question. They circle it and they mark it. A voice analysis is where an expert gets normal voice recordings, like they could be recording my conversation now, to see how I pronounce different words, how I pronounce different letters, how I say different enunciations in words. And then they take a recording that they have and compare the known sample to that recording to see if the fluctuations in the voice variances are so similar that they can reflect and say, this is this person's speech, this is how they talk, this is their dialect, and what have you. The problem you have in the Zimmerman trial is there's no just normal conversation recording of George Zimmerman or Trayvon Martin. What they're trying to analyze is that 1 5-second audio tape of a 911 call were barely audible in the background is someone screaming, help me, help me. And part of what the defense is saying is that experts have been called in, and experts' voice analysis is reliable, but it's reliable when we're having a conversation like you and I are having right now. But in the heated conversation, when people are screaming and yelling, and you have nothing to compare that to, it's not reliable. So that's what Judge Nelson is going to have to determine. Is whether or not this is reasonable and it's sound scientific evidence that a jury can rely on in making and rendering a decision.
And let's take a moment right now so that I can announce your law firm. The attorney with us this evening is Eric Dubois. He's from the Dubois Law Group. And the phone number to that office is 321-236-4671. Is that correct?
That's it.
And we wanted to let you know that the difference, and it's come up so many times in cases like these, there is a big difference between a polygraph exam, which, as you explained, is inadmissible in a Florida court, and the actual voice analysis exam. And I remember early on when George Zimmerman was brought in, he requested a voice analysis test. He requested that right away.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you about new media, because one of the questions I had for Robert Zimmerman, and no, he did not answer me yesterday when we asked this question. I asked in the past, and I asked again, when he uses new media, for instance, Twitter, and he makes statements that were a bit fierce and controversial, I asked, are you going to stop that and stop sending out those tweets during the trial? And the answer had always been very evasive. And I asked outright, again, at his press he threw in an impromptu press conference before the jury, before they began jury selection. And I asked him, are you going to stop that? And in the press conference, he says, oh, no, I never agreed to that. We didn't discuss it, and I didn't agree to it. What he forgot was that he and I had been emailing back and forth, so I actually have those questions in writing. But I was surprised. I would have thought that by now, since we have this new technology, such as Twitter, that the judge would make statements about friends and relatives sending out tweets that are going to fuel the fire or make situations worse and make controversial statements that get people in tremendous emotional arguments. We'll say that. We'll have people stop using new media to incite more emotions and to, like I said, fuel the fire.
Well, I mean, I think part of, you know, it's a balancing test. I mean, part of what the judge has to balance is an individual's First Amendment rights to freedom of speech. And Robert Zimmerman's brother is on trial, not Robert Zimmerman. So he has a right to say what he wants to say. Prior to jury selection, Trayvon Martin's family appeared before a podium and just asked for, you know, the public to remain calm and to have faith in the jury system and give it a try and you know, to let things be. You know, obviously, there's been comments on both sides that one can say have incited tension. Obviously, you know, in a case such as this, you can't get away from potential racial tensions that are going to evolve during the trial, come out during the trial. I know there's reporters, local reporters who have live tweets and updates going from the courtroom. I'd be surprised if the judge restricts the family's ability to comment and talk. I think knowing the attorneys on the defense side, I think they're going to take the reins a little bit and control things from the Zimmerman family once the jury's impaneled and just let it play out. Mark Ramirez is a great and very well-respected attorney in town, and I don't see him putting up with that much longer, personally. But I don't see the judge saying, okay, I'm restricting everyone's right to tweet or to Facebook or to say this or say that. I think part of that is, you know, she'd be walking a fine line with how restrictive she could be on, you know, someone's First Amendment rights, especially when they're not the accused or they're not on trial. But at the same time, she's got a test to, you know, a standard to evaluate. She's got to make sure that Mr. Zimmerman gets a fair and impartial trial. And if the jury's not going to be sequestered, how much of that information is going to get out to them and will get to them? You know, you can't, it's going to be next to impossible to prevent anyone on that jury, if they're not sequestered, from seeing, hearing, or, you know, overhearing something about that trial in the next, you know, month. No, it's going to be front page of the Orlando Sentinel. All the major news, local news media here are going to have gavel-to-gavel coverage on TVs. It's going to be streaming in office waiting rooms. It's going to be streaming in, you know, coffee shops on the weekends, highlights, you know, reruns, recaps, all that. You know, Bill Schaefer's doing, he's doing legal analysis on Channel 9. I'm going to be doing something on the local Channel 6, the CBS affiliate here. So it's going to be next to impossible to avoid it. It's just a matter of how restricted can you be on those who aren't per se involved in the litigation.
And did Kate McCross conversation as to the Stand Your Ground law, it was only 2005 when they actually enacted it here in Florida, and it's been highly controversial. Do you think that in light of this case, the Stand Your Ground law will remain a standard law in Florida, or do you think that this case might be one of the catalysts that begins its demise?
I don't think it'll begin its demise. I think you may see some reform of the Stand Your Ground law. I think it's here to stay. I don't think it's going anywhere. You know, Florida also is very liberal, and we used to have, you know, I mean, basically when the Stand Your Ground law came out, people said you could shoot first and ask questions later, is how, you know, liberally people construed the statute. You know, it basically meant you could do whatever you want and just say, I was afraid for my safety, and that was your perfect defense. So I think there's going to be some reform. I know there was a push this past year in the legislature to make some changes to the law. I don't believe any of them really went through. But I think there's going to be some change to it, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere in the state of Florida. And I know there's, I want to say, 13 or 14 other states that have a similar law, and I don't see it going anywhere in those states either. I think, if anything, you're going to see more states getting some sort of stand your ground law. You know, unfortunately, in response to some of these school shootings and what have you, to make sure that, you know, someone has a right to protect themselves.
And I noticed that the NRA, of course, has stepped into the argument across the nation. Their position is that everyone assume the position to take up arms. That is their preference. And that's been a big difficulty here when they're trying to keep the peace and keep things calm, because if everyone takes up arms, it will, I don't know if it's going to be a dangerous or a calm setting, or if that's going to fuel the fires to have more violence in the streets.
You know, I think when this stuff in Newtown happened, you know, the NRA's position was that the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. You know, so that kind of puts into perspective what their position is with regards to gun control and who has the right to bear arms. Personally, I'm a believer in the Second Amendment. I think people have a right to bear arms. I think, though, that there's some changes that can be made to the law. There's some changes that can be made to the Stand Your Ground law to protect people. I mean, this situation is very unfortunate and very sad. You have Trayvon lost
yes.
his life because he was, you know, innocently, you know, confronted, is what the state thing, you know, and that's what happened. But no one really knows, like I said at the beginning, there's one person, unfortunately, there's two people that know what happened. Unfortunately, one of them's alive. And that's what the question is going to be, as to what really happened. And I don't know how you can do this case without George Zimmerman testifying. And I think, unfortunately, the gun lobby and the political beliefs and the religious beliefs and the moral beliefs, and that's what's going to take the jury selection so long, is because you're going to have to sort through all of that. Obviously, the defense would love a jury of all, you know, not to stereotype, but all NRA members, would love 10 NRA members to be on the jury. The state's going to say, no, we can't have all that, because we need people that, you know, don't believe that everyone should have a right to a gun. And, you know, that's one factor. But it's gonna take a while.
It's going to take a while indeed. And let's announce again that Eric Dubois is from the Dubois Law Group in Orlando, Florida. And his phone number at the office is 321-236-4671.
No, I haven't had a case with a stand your ground issue. You know, there aren't, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, there aren't many that come up every year. Especially this high profile.
And I noticed that every day Trayvon Martin's family is present, his father and his mother. And I have to say, for Trayvon Martin's family, what a dignified, quiet pair his parents are. I've always noticed that Mrs. Sabrina Fulton is a very dignified, noble woman. She's very quiet, and the amount of self-control and her so noble in her quiet alone is just so restrained and so almost elegant. In this tragedy,
yeah.
It's a terrible thing to say, but there's a quiet elegance about the noble way in which she conducts herself. It's there's no replacement for the loss of a child. And they say a mother can only be as happy as her saddest child. It's such a serious situation, and we can't say, well, I would do this or I would do that. Unless you have lost a child, you can't possibly begin to understand the feeling of loss. In fact, I don't know if it'll be a few months or many months, after this trial, here at Syndicated News, we're going to air a program where we have actually discussed with a member of law enforcement in Sanford and a member of a family. And, well, we're going to discuss law. We've already discussed it with a member of law enforcement and a member of the medical profession. And we asked the same questions. What happens? What type of loss does an individual suffer? And my goodness, they suffer social, economic, legal losses. When there is a loss like this, where a child has been injured or has died as a result of an incident like this, the losses that both sides suffer are unbelievable, because society in itself not only isolates the individual who is involved in the crime, either as a victim or as the person accused, but so too is that individual's spouse, the parents, the siblings, and society as a whole, to avoid it, will stop interacting with the individuals. And that is something that I would say it's human nature, because you don't know what to say. You know, they say, oh, I ran into so-and-so, and they had just lost a child, and I didn't know what to say. That is so true. In a time like that, you don't know what to say.
Right. But, and, you know, they've, from the beginning, they've handled themselves with dignity and class and have used their tragedy to the benefit, you know, to try and make changes to the law, raise awareness, and carry on, you know, Trayvon Martin's memory in a positive and in a good light. You know, I think once the trial is over, it'll probably all sink in, and to have to sit there and relive, you know, the last seconds of your son's life, as they're going to have to for the next, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, I imagine is going to be incredibly brutal on them. And, you know, just hope that, you know, they're able to maintain their composure and handle themselves accordingly. They also are represented by very good attorneys, Ben Crump and Natalie Jackson, and I'm sure they've talked to them and gotten them the psychological and spiritual help, whatever they need to get them through this, and have explained to them that they need to, you know, handle themselves in a manner that, you know, Trayvon would be happy of and proud of, and let the legal system handle itself and do what it's got to do. But they've been very impressive as to how they've behaved and composed themselves and spoken and what their message has been from the beginning.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us and helping us along with these legal definitions, because the legal definitions in conversation, I notice, have become quite critical, because so many members of the public want to have an opinion and want to offer an opinion naturally, but they're unfamiliar with what these statements are and what these statements mean. For instance, when today they were discussing basically that French expression, what it means is to tell the truth. They want to sort out who's actually telling the truth from those who want to be involved, because it's such an interesting case where they want to write a book or be involved with something that they feel is bigger than life. Let's face it, this story is just, it's on everyone's lips. It's hard to go anywhere, to turn on the radio, open a newspaper, go online, or in general, sit at any supper table where there's regular discussion when someone's not going to bring up this case. And they're sorting between those that want to be involved for excitement's sake and those who really want to live up to their obligation and serve as a juror and be fair. And one wonderful thing that came up in this case as we were dealing with it was that our CEO gave us a statement, which I thought was profound, in that they were saying, it was our CEO who said that we have to be fair and we have to avoid pretrial publicity whenever possible, because we affect a case in such a negative way. We have to steer away from that, and be quiet. If in doubt, say nothing, because it's such a serious situation that could affect people. And that goes for everyone. We have to steer clear of making these opinions that could be used later as cause for argument.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, we just need to have faith in the system, have faith in laws, have faith in what men and women have died for in giving this country and our freedoms, and that at the end of the day, everything happens and everything will happen for a reason, and it will work itself out, and it is what it is. It'll be what it is. I mean, some people are wrongfully convicted. Some people are, wrongfully acquitted. But at the end of the day, it's probably the American justice system is the best in the world, and we just need to have faith in it.
And I came across a statement here. It was actually contributed. The contributor was John McEwen, our CEO, and he wrote, as part of an article that we wrote about this case, he wrote, "It is our aim at Syndicated News to report fairly and evenly in all things. The principle of freedom of the press is important, as we all know, but for the press to create opinions that can affect the case one way or another prior to its trial is not the proper position for them to take. Opinionated reporting can possibly affect the outcome of any case in a way that is not intended. We hope that those that take sides do so with caution and allow the facts to present the case and for the jury to decide. As history shows, many obvious conclusions to cases have been thrown out due to creating prejudicial publicity prior to an actual trial." And those words are so profound. That was the contribution made by our CEO, John McEwen. And they are very serious words. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, but the problem is, how do you, without stepping on the media's toes and infringing on, the media's rights and the media outlets' rights, how do you stop, pretrial publicity? I mean, a case like this is, unfortunately, it's the sensationalism and the sadness about this story that sells newspapers and drives the media and drives articles and magazines and books and all that to be written. And it's with social media nowadays and Twitter and all that, it's almost impossible to stop it. I mean, the Casey Anthony trial was probably the first social media trial in the country. And this, that was 3 years ago, 2 years ago. So there's so much more technology and so much more publicity, and more users on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all of that. And, these blog talk radio shows and the internet shows. And, I don't see how you could ever stop it. You just hope to kind of contain it. And Florida has very open public records laws and right to, all of the information being made public and being provided to the media outlets and the media being able to, obtain court records and court documents. And, we at one point want, privacy and we want nothing to be made public, but at the same time, then we want everything to be out in the open and so everyone can have confidence in the system. And you can't have it both ways.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's such an important point about Florida's Sunshine Law. Would you give us a moment and explain to the public what that is about the open records and the fact that both records here are open?
Sure. Basically, Florida has what's called the Sunshine Law. It basically says that any meeting between two elected officials, any meeting of a board that's dealing with government or, policy-making decisions needs to be published. The meeting needs to be open to the public. Anyone can come observe. The court system is open to the public. court documents, with the exception of certain types of proceedings, adoptions, cases of, you know, victims' names can be, you know, protected in sexual assault cases or, you know, rape cases. But all those records should be open and made available to the public, so for public scrutiny. Some, you know, obviously there's a lot that goes into these cases. You know, in this case, you know, the volumes of discovery, all of that stuff is accessible. Anyone can go to the courthouse and pull the file and review the documentation. A lot, obviously, some of it's going to be redacted, and the names of witnesses and phone numbers and personal information can be protected. But Florida has very broad and very open public records laws, and for the most part, if it's filed, it's available to the community to see. So,
and in a case like this, if it were happening in any other state, but if a case like this, if something tragic like this happens where there's a weapon produced, if we already have the Stand Your Ground law, add to that that we have the Sunshine Law, it makes for a very different set of circumstances than if this same incident occurred in another state where there is no Sunshine Law.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, that's why so much of this case, you know, the media knows, the media has seen so much of the evidence, so much of the paperwork that the, you know, the state of Florida has turned over to the defense, because it's been filed with the, you know, it's been filed with the court. And that's why in a situation like this, in a situation in Solomon Casey Anthony trial, we all knew what was coming. It's just a matter of how is it presented, what's admissible, what's not admissible, and what's the jury really going to see, and what's the story that goes on between in the courtroom versus the story that is going to be portrayed in the media, and the story that we all the evidence that we still don't know what's going to be in and what's going to be out in this case.
Well, again, we want Eric to announce his website.
Sure. It's Dubois Law Group. It's DuboisLawGroup.com. It's D as in David, U, B as in boy, O-I-S as in Sam, Law Group. And our offices are in downtown Orlando. And we're happy to help anyone and offer free consultations and be happy to talk to anyone about anything.
I can't thank you enough for joining us this evening and clarifying those points on the Sunshine Law and on Stand Your Ground, because those are two points that have come up in conversation, I would say, every 10 minutes when I'm talking to someone outside of the Florida region. And we'll have a conversation on something totally different, and right away, what is the Sunshine Law? What exactly is this Stand Your Ground? And I wanted you to come on and just explain that to us, because having an attorney explain it, I think you gave us the clearest explanation of both those situations, and we're very grateful because that we got that out of the way, and now we've got that established. And we'll be getting together here on Syndicated News again. Jury selection has begun. And we will be here at Syndicated News with Blog Talk Radio from time to time during this trial. And we will be bringing you information, gavel to gavel. We're covering this case day to day. We are there every day. And Eric, I can't thank you enough for helping us with this. We're really very appreciative.
I'm glad to do it, and I look forward to being back on the show in the future, and as the case develops, talking about what's happened and what's going on and what we can expect to happen in the coming days.
Absolutely. And I thank you, and for all of you that are listening and those that are not in the United States that are listening, we have at this point 72 countries that follow syndicatednews.net on the air. And we had no idea that we had a huge following now in Asia and India especially. We were very surprised, and we were asked that when we speak English, would we please speak slowly, because many of the people listening and joining us are from overseas, and they're very interested. We were very surprised at the stretch, the countries from which people are wanting to ask questions about the case. So they're following us in places as far as Dubai. And they're certainly following us in Egypt and in Venezuela, in Santiago, Chile, where we have our sister station, in Malaysia, where we have a sister station. And we're noticing that this is not, how would I say, limited to Orlando, Florida, or Sanford, Florida. It's a case that's reaching families all over the world, because it happens all over the world. Anyway, Eric, thank you so much, and we look forward to having you join us again and clarify so many points as you did this evening.
Glad to do it. Look forward to being back.